Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show! So the chief complaint is 32-year-old female presenting with left facial numbness for 5 days.
Left facial numbness for 5 days. Excellent. Drea, in just a few months, you might see a patient like this. What would start coming to mind for you?
Left facial numbness for 5 days. Well, it's kind of subacute. I would not immediately think of something vascular because it's been a few days. It's been almost a week. I would maybe ask her more about triggers, ask her what started it, because there may be more of like a facial paralysis component triggered by an infection, for example. So yes, those are my first thoughts, like just the subacute nature. I would just start by collecting more history and understanding how it all started.
Great. And we'll get some of that information soon. Just for now, Andrea, you said this is not sudden, so it's very unlikely to be a stroke, although we don't know yet from the history. Maybe it started suddenly 5 days ago and has been static, so we'll want to determine that. What other kinds of things would you be thinking about, Andrea, if it turns out this is not sudden, but has been evolving or worsening for 5 days? What other kinds of things would you think about related to that time course?
Well, the first thing that I thought about was a Bell's palsy, as I mentioned, a facial weakness or paralysis that could be triggered by an infection, for example. Another thing I could think of that is associated with like brief episodes of facial numbness sometimes, it's kind of atypical, would be some sort of like headaches, trigeminal neuralgia, migraines, but it is not as common as I remember right now. Now, I don't know her past medical history, but I would think also maybe some like an episode of multiple sclerosis or of a peripheral neuropathy. Other things that are non-neurological would be like something dental. Is there something dental going on, like a dental abscess or maybe like a sinus inflammation?
Excellent. All great thoughts. So yeah, mentioned a lot of interesting things there. For example, mentioned Bell's palsy, which is the eponym for an idiopathic seventh nerve palsy causing facial weakness, not sensory loss. But a lot of patients with that will say their face feels numb, something about the face not moving. It just, some people will describe that as numb, even though we as clinicians looking at it would say, actually, it's weak. And there's usually not objective numbness. So first question will be to really, when we get the history, understand what's meant by numbness. Is it a sense of blankness when they touch their face, or is it tingling? You mentioned migraine. People can have facial tingling as part of their migraine aura, paresthesias. It's not all visual aura. Or is it actually weakness? And the patient's subjective experience of not being able to move the face, they're calling it numbness, but it's actually weak. And then, as you said, we always want to know, is it neurologic or non-neurologic? Is this some dental sensation that's being described? Since it's not dentistry VMR, it's neurology VMR. I think A probably brought us a neurology case. So you mentioned also, if this was not sudden, but has been evolving over 5 days, could it be a demyelinating plaque somewhere to cause facial numbness? And we'll maybe go more into that if it becomes more relevant. All great thoughts. Sridhar, what's coming to mind for you? And then I'll give some thoughts as well.
Yeah, I mean, when I hear the chief complaint, I like to think fast and think slow. And you hear a 32-year-old female with 5 days of facial numbness, the first thing that comes to mind is demyelinating. But then, think slow, you slow down, you say, could this, like both of you have mentioned, could this be acute onset stroke and now it's static? Could this be something local, or could this be something that is headache related? Or could this just be a Bell's palsy where proprioception being impaired can lead to a weird facial?
Fantastic. Yeah, also great thoughts. Yeah, we heard a little more than the chief concern. That's a 32-year-old female with a focal neurologic deficit. Could be male or female, but the condition multiple sclerosis is a little more common in women. We heard 32 focal deficit, 5 days, sort of whatever the deficit. I think multiple sclerosis might be on our minds with some acute demyelinating attack. Okay, we've talked sort of about this symptom, and as everyone knows, I'd like to divide our analysis into localization and time course. So we've talked a little bit about the time course, which isn't entirely clear, although it's somewhat circumscribed. This isn't chronic, right? It's not months to years. It's not subacute. It's not weeks to months. It's either with sudden onset and has stayed and the patient has decided, well, it hasn't gone away for 5 days, I better come in, or it's been emerging over 5 days. So it's either hyperacute or acute. And I like to divide what some people call acute into hyperacute, meaning truly sudden or instant, versus acute, emerging, evolving over hours to days because they have different differential diagnoses. So if it happens suddenly 5 days ago and has been static, yeah, you might think of a vascular event. And if it's happened over hours to days and it's been evolving in that way, we've thought about immune-mediated processes like multiple sclerosis, and then hard to think of a particular location for an infection, a very small abscess or something somewhere in the brain or brainstem causing this. But those would sort of be the time course pieces. Now, what about the localization? Let's take it at face value and say it's numbness. Well, what supplies the sensation to the face or brings sensory information from the face back to the nervous system? It's a cranial nerve. Which cranial nerve is it, Andrea? Do you remember?
The trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5.
Perfect. Trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5. Trigeminal, I don't know Latin or Greek, but Gemini, like the zodiac, it's the three twins, I think. And so the twins, it's cranial nerve 5. There's two of them. And then the three branches, ophthalmic, maxillary, mandibular. I guess that's what it means. I don't know. Maybe someone can fact check me while I'm talking. So the sensation from the face, like all the cranial nerves, is connected to the brainstem, goes back to the brainstem, and we'll see if the brainstem becomes relevant. But quick way of remembering how the cranial nerves sort of connect to the brainstem is that you can think of, for the midbrain, the pons and the medulla, there's three levels, 12 pairs of cranial nerves, 12 divided by 3 is 4. So you can generally think 1, 2, 3, 4 for the midbrain, 5, 6, 7, 8 for the pons, 9, 10, 11, 12 for the medulla, with some exceptions, 1 and 11 don't go to the brainstem. Cranial nerve 8 sort of straddles the pontomedullary junction. And then 5 is one of the exceptions, and that it actually has nuclei at all three levels of the brainstem. So it enters or exits, depending on how you look at it, the pons, where you'd expect 5, 6, 7, 8. But then the different sensory information goes to different nuclei. So right there in the pons is where the motor nucleus for the muscles of mastication is. That's actually very rarely affected clinically. And then right next to that is the chief or main or principal, the sensory nucleus of 5, depending which book you read, it has different names. That's for light touch in the face. And then the pain and temperature information actually goes down to the medulla, up to the upper cervical spinal cord in the spinal tract of 5, spinal nucleus and tract of 5, crosses to the other side and then comes back up to join the spinothalamic tract. And then little known fact, there's a mesencephalic nucleus of 5 for proprioception in the face. Mesencephalic is the midbrain, that's in the midbrain. No real clinical relevance to that I'm aware of. And then all of that sensory information finds its way to line up with the sensory information from the body. The proprioceptive lines up with the medial lemniscus, the pain and temperature with the spinothalamic tracts and the brainstem, and then they all travel together to the thalamus. And then the facial information goes to VPM, the ventral posterior medial nucleus of the thalamus, and the bodily information to VPL, ventral posterior lateral nucleus of the thalamus. And all of that finds its way to the somatosensory cortex in the postcentral gyrus of the parietal lobe. Okay, so that means if we have facial numbness from distally to proximally, we could have a problem in the trigeminal nerve. We could have a problem in the brainstem. We could have a microscopic problem just in VPM of the thalamus, or we could have a problem in the facial areas of the sensory cortex, which is sort of lateral and somewhat superior, just below the hand area. Now, if you think about it, to get facial numbness alone, we haven't heard, maybe A will tell us there's also numbness, weakness, other places, but it's really just facial numbness. It'd be pretty hard to get a brainstem lesion causing just facial numbness. There's so much stuff packed together in there to get just facial numbness. And to get just some lesion of just the part of the cortex or subcortical white matter that's just getting the facial fibers of sensation or just getting VPM without getting VPL next to it in the thalamus, all pretty unlikely, not impossible. So it would make us think we're more kind of in the trigeminal pathway here. Now, both of you mentioned multiple sclerosis, young woman, focal neurologic deficit, 5 days. How would someone with multiple sclerosis get facial numbness? It's true that they can, but it's a central nervous system disease. How could they affect the trigeminal pathway? People with multiple sclerosis can actually get and can even present with trigeminal neuralgia, which we usually think of as sort of non-lesional. It's just something irritates the nerve. It can be a vascular loop and gets electric radiating pain into the face. We haven't heard that here. We've heard numbness instead. And then people will say, well, trigeminal neuralgia, the cranial nerves are peripheral, except cranial nerve 2. How do you get trigeminal neuralgia, or in this case, trigeminal neuropathy from multiple sclerosis? Anyone know the answer to that riddle?
It affects the sheath around the trigeminal nerve, like where it enters the brainstem?
Not the sheath, actually, because the sheath is peripheral myelin. Yeah, sort of a, not a trick question, but a kind of very gourmet question, if you will. Yeah, it affects the trigeminal nerve entry zone. So the trigeminal, there's the trigeminal nerve, there's a trigeminal nucleus. Nucleus in neurology means the collection of cell bodies. But there's the part of the nerve that's still in the brainstem that's called the fascicle. It's the white matter of the nerve, either on its way out or on its way in, but it's in the brainstem proper. If you had a demyelinating lesion at the trigeminal entry zone, you could get trigeminal neuropathy, trigeminal neuralgia. And I suppose a very small demyelinating plaque in the corona radiata, sort of near the face area of the cortex, you could get that.
You can do the same thing to the eighth nerve and cause a vestibular pseudoneuronitis. So they look present with vertigo.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So these are these things where people say it looks like a cranial neuropathy, and actually it's a cranial nerve, but it's still in the central nervous system component of it. Great. So we think we have something along the trigeminal pathway, which could be brainstem or trigeminal nerve, really just facial numbness, thinking of something more likely to be in the nerve itself, since it'd be hard to get just that with a central lesion, though not impossible. And then we're thinking it either happened suddenly 5 days ago and it could be something vascular, or it's emerged over 5 days. And then we're thinking something potentially inflammatory, demyelinating. Only other thing to put out there, what else can cause facial numbness on one side? If it's the whole face or branches of the trigeminal nerve, we're thinking something trigeminal. You can get a trigeminal neuropathy, painless numb area of the face in Sjogren syndrome, and it can be the presentation. I've never seen that in practice, but it's reported. And then people should be familiar with this numb chin sign. Andrea or Sridhar, do you know the numb chin sign?
Can be, at least when what we have been taught traditionally is when you see someone with numb chin, you should always think of involvement of a perineural infiltration by a malignancy of the branch of the trigeminal that is supplying the chin. So even though it is a complaint that is not considered at first glance something serious, it can be a serious etiology.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I remember learning this as a resident too, something that seemed so benign, as Sridhara said, just sort of your chin is a little numb, which is a very sinister symptom. It's often malignant infiltration of the distal branches of the trigeminal nerve. And the patient will say, they just have a little patch. Well, it's usually metastatic disease, and usually the patient, it's already known that they have cancer. It's rare for cancer to present that way. And it can be missed on CT, on MRI. You have to get some type of dental x-ray to look for it. This is a young person, so probably unlikely, but just to put it on everyone's radar, that numb chin sounds benign, but in some cases can be malignant infiltration. Okay, A, can you give us some more information? We have a lot of things we want to know, right? Is it really numbness? Is it weakness? Is it tingling? Is it pain? Was it sudden onset and stayed, or did it emerge? Are there any other signs of numbness, weakness elsewhere in the body, or just facial numbness? So fill us in, A. What did you learn talking to this patient?
Sure. It's such a rich discussion. Thank you so much, all. So history of present illness, it said that is 2-year-old female, right-handed person, presented with left facial numbness for 5 days. It was gradual onset. She had 2 extractions before that, and she was just thinking it's just because of the 2 extractions. But she also had a history of facial asymmetry, which was just treated as Bell's palsy 1.5 years ago. She had no facial pain, but still had facial asymmetry and decreased hearing on the left side. She also had numbness on the left side of the tongue, and she was speaking with slurred speech. She walked with unsteady gait, but there was no tendency to sway to other sides. And it was also gradually worsening. She also described a clumsy hand on the left side, but there was no blur vision, double vision, dysphagia, headache, vertigo, loss of conscious, or phase of visual hallucination. And there was no weakness or history of fall or tripping over or numbness on the body. She also denied loss of appetite or loss of weight. She was previously healthy, no history of runny nose, sore throat, nausea, vomiting, or dyspnea, or dysuria, or abdominal pain. And this is the end of the first article.
Excellent. A, is there up to you to decide how you want to present the case, but should we just, since a young, healthy person, anything to know about past medical meds, any of that stuff, or you want us to discuss and you'll tell us soon? If it's nothing, you can tell us now. If it's something you're saving for later, that's fine too.
I can tell about the past medical surgical history. It was mostly unremarkable. For past medical history, there was no history of migraine or fits or meningitis, encephalitis, or head injury. And past surgical history also unremarkable. Like family history, there was no history of brain tumor or neurocutaneous disease or motor neuron disease in her family. And also social history, that she works at her family business grocery shop, and there was no history of alcohol, smoking, or other drug usage. And also drug history, she was not on any current drugs or no known allergy.
Excellent. Okay. Andrea, it seems it's not just facial numbness. What else is going on here? How does this help us with the localization?
So as she was presenting, it did sound initially like maybe there was some vulnerability of the facial nerve to get like a Bell's palsy recurrence. But then when she mentioned clumsy hand, it does kind of point that there is a central nervous system involvement. So I think there could be, for example, a demyelinating plaque in the brainstem, maybe in the pons where the trigeminal nerve nuclei is, or in some of the other pathways. But I think she doesn't have any motor deficits for me to suggest that there is involvement of the corticospinal tract to have a better idea of where it is localized. But I guess my first thought would still be that it could be a central nervous system demyelinating lesion, and this could be episodic, as we can see that she has a history of presenting with similar episodes in the past.
Yeah, great points. I'm going to ask you a few questions, but first, just to clarify with A, this quote, Bell's palsy, the seventh nerve palsy, is on the same side?
Yes, it's on the left side.
And it has persisted, it didn't go away, is that right?
Yeah, has persisted.
Okay. And the hearing loss, is that one side, yes. Both sides?
It's just on the left side.
Yeah. So I have a question for you, Andrea. Which cranial nerves are affected here, if you had to list them off, and which cranial nerves are not affected?
Okay, so first, the trigeminal nerve is affected, as we mentioned, maybe like at the more at the mandibular branch, but I'm not sure yet. The combination of symptoms, if we thought of like the pons, for example, I would think maybe cranial nerves 5, which is the trigeminal 7th. Yes, 7th and 8th, the vestibular cochlear. Okay. So that would kind of explain if there's some crosstalk between the nerve fibers, some of the symptoms, including the hearing symptoms.
Fantastic. Now I want to work together with you a little bit more because this is a complicated case, but is an important localizing syndrome to be aware of, which is the syndrome of multiple cranial neuropathies, right? This patient has multiple cranial neuropathies. I don't think we've had a case of this before at BMR, so let's take some time with this. So when there are multiple cranial neuropathies, there's a few possibilities. One is that there's a lesion in the brainstem, as you suggested, getting their nuclei or their fascicles. Nuclei, again, the cell bodies, fascicle is the part of the cranial nerves that's still in the brainstem before it comes out. So it could be a lesion in the brainstem. It could be a lesion in the subarachnoid space, meaning the nerves finding their way along from the brainstem to their ultimate target. It could be a lesion in the skull base, so that nerves all have to get through the skull to their ultimate targets, 2, 3, 4, 6 to the orbit, 5 and 7 to the face, 8 to the inner ear, 9, 10, 11, 12 to the mouth and larynx and pharynx, et cetera. And then it could be in the ultimate end target, either in the orbit itself, if it's a lot of eye stuff, in the retropharyngeal space for stuff related to 9, 10, 12, in the neck for 9, 10, 11, 12. So multiple cranial neuropathies, your possibilities are brainstem, subarachnoid space, skull base, or sort of distally in the orbit face, neck. Okay, so how do you sort it out? Couple of principles. Well, one is you're looking for kind of groups. So if you saw 2, 3, 4, maybe you're up in the midbrain. If you saw, as Andrea was saying, there's 5, 7, 8, there's not 6 here. So we'll talk about that in a moment. Maybe you're in the pons. If you saw 9, 10, 12, and either end, or maybe you're in the medulla. But if you have multiple cranial neuropathies and you have no weakness or numbness in the body, which A has told us, it's pretty hard to put the lesion in the brain stem, right? Because you have the long tracts there. If you have a dorsal brainstem syndrome, so you have sensory 5 and 8, like in this case, then how come you haven't gotten the somatosensory pathways for the body that are on the way up? And if it's more medial brainstem syndrome, M medial, M motor, the motor nuclei are closer to the midline, 3, 4, 6, 12, and then motor 5, 7, 9, 10, just lateral to that. So we have this triangle of in the middle, 3, 4, 6, 12, the next column out, 5, 7, 9, 10, 5 motor, and then the most lateral 5 and 8. So it's motor at the midline, bronchial motor a little lateral, and then sensory and special sensory most lateral. Okay, if you're at the midline, 3, 4, 6, 12, 7, 9, 10, a little off the midline, then wouldn't you get the motor pathways for the body and get weakness? This is how you get these cross signs that the USMLE loves, but are actually very rare in real life, where you have a third on one side and weakness on the other in the brainstem. That's Weber's, in the midbrain, that's Weber syndrome. You have a 6 and 7 on one side. You have weakness on the other side. I think that's Millard-Gubler syndrome. You have sensory loss on one side of the face, the opposite side of the body, and lateral medullary syndrome, a bunch of other stuff with that. That's Wallenberg syndrome. So if you don't have any long tract signs and the patient is awake and they've taken out multiple cranial nerves, probably it's not going to be in the brainstem. So then our next step is to say, is there any place where all these cranial nerves run together in the skull base? So there are all kinds of syndromes, orbital apex syndrome, 2, 3, 4, V1, and 6. There is cavernous sinus syndrome, 3, 4, 6, V1, V2. There is jugular foramen syndrome, 9, 10, and 11. There's, I forget the names of them in the neck, 9, 10, 11, 12, and a Horner's for a carotid dissection. There are all kinds of these syndromes. There are tables of them. So this patient seems to have 5, 7, and 8. They skipped 6, probably not in the pons. Is there any place in the skull base or in the subarachnoid space where 5, 7, and 8 are together?
The cerebellopontine angle.
Yeah. So there's a place called the cerebellopontine angle where 5 and 8 are on the way in and 7 is on the way out. That's sort of the angle between the pons and the cerebellum. And look what else we have, that the patient is clumsy on one side. On the left side, I presume, unless A has a very tricky localized problem. So this patient has progressive picking off of these cranial nerves, 7, 8, 5, and now some ataxia. So that localizes to the cerebellopontine angle. And so we could have said 7 and 8 together. That can also be internal auditory canal. I forgot that one. But 5 doesn't go through there. It goes partially through the cavernous sinus and partially through the valle for V3. So we're somewhere sort of subarachnoid space. So that sort of localizes around there. The other thing to say about multiple cranial neuropathies, just to finish that little mini talk here, you have brainstem, subarachnoid space, skull base, and then distally, what I call fake outs, that doesn't localize. So for example, myasthenia gravis, patients can have some facial weakness, some 3, 4, 6. Guillain-Barré, the cranial nerves are peripheral nerves, so people always think ascending paralysis, but you can get facial weakness. You can get Miller-Fisher syndrome with 3, 4, and 6. So that's sort of a fake-out localization. Botulism is another one, multiple cranial neuropathies. Usually those are going to be bilateral. Okay, so no long track signs, so we're probably not in the brainstem or subarachnoid space or skull base. And then we said, is there any place, if you look at these tables, you have this 2, 3, 4, V1, 6, 3, 4, B1, B2, 6. Then you have, I think, 5 and 6 is that Petrix apex Grad-Mego syndrome, 7 and 8 internal auditory canal, and then 5, 7, and 8 is the cerebellopontine angle. Now we're in that cerebellopontine angle. A has told us there was facial weakness that everyone would have thought Bell's palsy, but it didn't go away. Usually Bell's palsy gets better. That's why we follow these patients. And if it doesn't, and especially if the patient starts picking off other cranial nerves, we worry about some focal expanding lesion that's now not going on for 5 days, but going on for 1.5 years. Andrea, do you know, no problem if not, what type of lesion might be growing slowly at the cerebellopontine angle?
I do actually, and it reminded me, thanks to someone in the chat. I think an acoustic neuroma or like vestibular schwannoma is a tumor that localizes in this area.
Fantastic. Yeah. Same name for, or different names for the same tumor. More accurate is vestibular schwannoma. It's a tumor of the Schwann cell of the vestibular branch. It usually causes hearing loss, so people say acoustic. And it's pushing on the nerve, so people say neuroma, but it's a vestibular schwannoma. Benign and not uncommon tumor to see slowly expanding there in that region, first affecting 8, although we can hear out of the other ear, and people often don't notice they're losing hearing. And if it progresses, 7, 5, and the cerebellum. There is a differential, though, Sridhar. What else can grow at the cerebellopontine angle?
Meningiomas can also grow at the cerebellopontine angle.
Yeah, the other big one would be a skull-based meningioma. Okay, so we're going to examine this patient, and we're going to confirm, is this lower motor neuron pattern facial weakness? We're going to confirm that there's hearing loss, sensory neural hearing loss on the left and normal on the right. We're going to see the distribution of that facial weakness. We're going to see if that clumsiness is ataxia as we would expect, or is it weakness and we're maybe confused here, and make sure there's no other signs pointing us away from this localization. So, A, when you examined this patient, what did you find?
So general examination, the vitals are normal, light temperature is 37, blood pressure is 110 over 60, heart rate is 90, respiratory rate and oxygen saturation is 100%. And generally, she was well and not dyspneic. In head and neck examination, there is no pillar, jaundice, or aura ulcer, or swelling, or erythema. On cerebrovascular examination, it was unremarkable, normal heart sound, no murmur. And pulmonary examination, it's on normal vestibular breath sound, no added sound, and abdomen soft, no tenderness or mass. On neurological examination, the patient is well and alert, and the gait is broad-based. She cannot do tandem walking. And on cranial nerve examination, cranial nerve 1, there was no anosmia, and fundoscopy was also normal. For cranial nerve 2, 3, 4, and 6, there was no blur vision, double vision, and eye movements are all intact, but there was horizontal nystagmus in both directions, but worse on the left side. For cranial nerve 5, there was reduced sensation on the left side on all V1, 2, and 3 areas, and there was also decreased sensation on the left side of the tongue. And the mesial muscle is also weak on the left side. On cranial nerve 7, there was left lower motor neuron facial palsy. And on cranial nerve 8, there was reduced hearing on the left side. On cranial nerve 9 and 10, it's all normal, no uvular deviation. On cranial nerve 11 and 12, there was it's all normal, no weakness, tan atrophy or fasciculation. And on motor examination, it was unremarkable inspection. There was no atrophy, and tone are all normal in all limbs, and power are all normal, 5x5 in all limbs, and reflexes are all normal, like 2+ in all limbs. And the plantars are also downgoing. On sensory examination, there was no numbness or sensory loss on the body. On cerebellar examination, was finger nose ataxia and dysdiagnosed glucokinesia on the left side. And on Hessian test, she couldn't do on the left side.
Fantastic. Brilliant presentation of a very detailed examination. I think that everything we expected to find, we found. There is one other element here worthy of discussion, which we didn't talk about, though maybe not a surprise that we found. So we found lower motor neuron pattern facial weakness. We found facial reduced sensation. We found hearing loss on the left. We found ataxia on the left, all things we were expecting. Maybe two fun points here. One is there's numbness on the tongue. Which cranial nerve does sensation on the tongue? Do we have to add a cranial nerve, or are we okay with 5, 7, and 8?
Cranial nerve 7.
Partially. Yeah, what does cranial nerve 7 do on the tongue?
Taste sensation.
Taste sensation on the anterior 2/3 of the tongue. The posterior 1/3 is 9, and then there's a little taste sensation on the epiglottis by the vagus, probably that if you eat something poisonous that makes you throw up kind of taste. So that's taste. What actually does the physical sensation? You touch your tongue and you feel it. Is that seven?
Is it the glossopharyngeal, maybe?
It's not nine. That's a good thought because, well, one, it has glosso in it, and two, it does so many miscellaneous things. It does one muscle, I think stylopharyngeus. It does one gland, the parotid. No, yeah, it does the...
cranial nerve five is the lingular nerve is the one that does the touch.
Yeah, so it's actually cranial nerve five. It's the sensation to the face, sensation to the cornea, sensation to the tongue. The tactile sensation to the tongue is five. Nine, the only sensation it does is a little patch of skin behind the ear. Nine does all these miscellaneous things. Sensation from the carotid body, one muscle, one gland, one area of sensation, one visceral. We don't talk about nine too much. I just talked about it too much, actually. Okay, so that was fun to talk about. Tongue sensation, taste is seven, but tactile is five. What about this nystagmus? A, can you tell us a little more about the nystagmus, actually? Do you know more about it? You mentioned something that it was horizontal nystagmus, and you said something else.
It was on the left side.
Yeah. And are you able to tell us in what direction was it beating, to the left and to the right? Do you know?
To the left.
It was always beating to the left?
Or the nystagmus?
Yeah. So when they look to the right, what direction did it beat to the left? Do you know? It's okay if you don't know.
It's beating in all directions, like both sides. That was on the left side, when the patient looked to the left side.
To the left side. Yeah. Do you know what's going on here? Nystagmus is complicated. This is a little bit gourmet.
So the way at least I think about it is I put it in two buckets, central or peripheral. So if I see direction changing nystagmus, so when you look to the left, it's left beating. The fast phase is left beating. Look to the right, then the fast phase is in a different direction. And up and down, it changes directions. That's central. Whereas if it's upbeating or pure downbeating, nystagmus again makes me think of central. Whereas if it's purely horizontal and it's worse on looking towards one ear, that makes me think of peripheral nystagmus.
Excellent. Yeah, so that's a great overview. I teach it the same way, Sridhara, of nystagmus 101. Direction changing, meaning looks left, beats to the left, looks to the right, it beats to the right, looks up, it beats up. That's central. It can just be from medications, drugs, but in the setting of acute vertigo, that would be very worrisome for a central etiology such as a stroke. Whereas peripheral, we don't have time to go into it today, but we've talked about this at prior morning reports where the chief concern is vertigo. If one side of the vestibular system is out, the brain thinks that the head is turning to the opposite side, so the eyes go toward the side of the lesion and then beat in the opposite direction to try to maintain fixation. So you get unidirectional nystagmus, sort of drifting to one side, correcting back, whereas central, you have gaze holding nystagmus where it's beating in the direction of gaze. If this patient has described it, they have components actually of both. When you have a lesion at the, this is nystagmus 202 or maybe 303, there are all these gourmet types of nystagmus, seesaw nystagmus and ping pong. I think there's one nystagmus, or maybe it's ping pong gaze. Anyway, there are lots of types of nystagmus. And this is one of those types called Bruns nystagmus, B-R-U-N-S, super gourmet. Only a neuro-ophthalmologist would know this. And one of my close colleagues when I was in Boston was a neuro-ophthalmologist, taught us all this stuff. If you have a lesion at the cerebellopontine angle affecting cranial nerve 8, or the vestibular nuclei pressing on it, you should get a peripheral pattern, like Sridhara said. The eyes should drift to the left and then beat back to the right. But if that lesion gets big enough and pushes on the cerebellum, and you get a central pattern of nystagmus, then you get direction-changing nystagmus. And what Bruns nystagmus is seen with vestibular schwannoma or meningioma. Bruns nystagmus is a combination of peripheral and central. So you get direction-changing nystagmus, and on top of that, you have this peripheral pattern. And I forget which way, but in one way, probably the way A told us, the nystagmus is sort of more coarse and rapid. And on the other side, it looks a little bit different. It's sort of the superimposition of direction changing and this vestibular pattern called Bruns nystagmus. And it localizes very specifically to a lesion at the cerebellopontine angle affecting 8 to get peripheral and the cerebellum to get central. I've seen it once or twice. I've read about it to try to make sense, but I'm not sure I taught it very clearly, but it's basically central and peripheral patterns combined. So cool to see that here and brilliant pickup by A to notice that it wasn't just direction changing, but there was something a little bit different about it. And that's called Bruns nystagmus. Okay, So if we think there's a lesion at the cerebellopontine angle, Andrea, you'll soon be a neurology resident being asked by the emergency room, what should we get, a CT or should we get an MRI? Do we need contrast or not? What test should I order? So if you want to diagnose this patient's lesion, what would you get, CT or MRI? And would you get contrast, no contrast? What would you tell your colleagues?
I would get an MRI of the brain and the brainstem, because I'm looking for demyelinated lesions or tumors or even like vascular abnormalities. But a CT, I don't think would have enough resolution to look at this problem. And I don't think we need contrast necessarily, because unless we were thinking that there was like an acute enhancing lesion in an acute episode of multiple sclerosis or something like that, it would be useful. But I think we can initially start with an MRI, just normal with no contrast.
Yeah, MRI, definitely agree with. This is not an acute situation where we want to get a CT fast and make sure we're not missing something that's needs to be intervened on or acted on immediately. This has been going on for over a year, so we have time. We can get an MRI. And on CT, you can see the posterior fossa, brainstem and cerebellum, but because it's surrounded by bone, there's a lot of beam hardening artifact. And often if you look at CTs, there's a lot of sort of lines going through the posterior fossa. It's a little hard to see what's going on back there. This tibular schwannoma or meningioma, we think it is pretty big at this point. We probably could see it on CT. But an MRI gives us a more detailed view. And do you know, Andrea, okay, if you don't, what a vestibular schwannoma looks like or acoustic neuroma looks like on MRI? Does it enhance with contrast? Is it ring enhancing, homogeneously enhancing, those kinds of things?
Yeah, so I think the vestibular schwannoma would just on a T1 classical MRI image, we just look as a hypointense lesion. And on a T2 image would appear as bright. I know tumors, actually, now that you mentioned, I know that tumors have sometimes enhancement to contrast. So it would be interesting to see the boundary of the tumor and see what other structures is it touching on, just to see exactly if it's displacing any parts of the brainstem or the cerebellum because of the mass effect. I guess in that case, the contrast would be very useful. So those are the findings that I would expect to see.
Perfect. Yeah, I agree with you. Contrast would be helpful here to look at the tumor. Usually these are contrast enhancing and they are homogeneously enhancing and they are sort of very almost perfectly circular in many cases. Something about how they grow. They can be very perfectly circular, at least the ones I've seen. And then they kind of might have a little kind of tail on them a little bit in the nerve, or sometimes where it's getting squeezed into or out of the internal auditory canal.
Compared to meningioma, they might have a little bit of a heterogeneous enhancement. Meningiomas, you enhance really uniform, whereas you can have more cysts and hemorrhages in schwannomas, and it's more irregular enhancement. That's helpful.
Yeah, the meningioma and vestibular schwannoma can be a little hard to tell the difference, but you're right. I think the meningioma can sometimes be a bit more heterogeneous. Excellent. Okay, A, tell us what you were thinking at this stage and your colleagues before you got the scan and what kind of scan you got. And then if there are other aliquots that we should address, please tell us. Or if you're ready to take us over the finish line, that's great also.
Yes, that is the initial labs are normal. And we just do MRI brain scan with contrast, and I can show you the imaging.
Okay, so tell us, MA, what sequence we're looking at here, you know?
So I think this is without contrast.
It's without contrast, it looks like a T1. Yeah. And we can already see here, by the way, do you want to point out for those who aren't so familiar? Yeah, there's a big circle here, and it's pressing into the brainstem and cerebellum, distorting its architecture. Yeah, okay, now we're up in the brain, which looks nice and healthy. This looks like a T2 to me because it looks like the negative, so we're probably going to see we're down by the medulla. Yep, keep going. There it is. So T1 hypointense, as Andrea said, T2 bright. I know it's the T2, by the way, because the CSF is bright. Look how bright the eyeballs are. Yeah, so very, very big lesion right where we thought it would be. Okay, you can see the brainstem getting distorted there. Yeah. So, Andrea, Sridhar, what should we do? We've made a diagnosis. Usually CP solvers ends there, but probably we should do something about this. Any thoughts on how we would treat this?
refer to the friendly neighborhood neurosurgeon.
Yeah, yeah. These are benign tumors in the sense that their pathology is benign. This has probably been there for years and years. They're not going to metastasize. They're not going to invade, but they're causing a lot of trouble by the nature of their mass effect. And once they get to a certain size, I forget what the criteria is, then they need to be operated on and removed. There is the risk of permanent hearing loss on that side. And there's also the risk of facial weakness on that side, but skull-based neurosurgeons trained in this procedure can do a facial nerve sparing procedure and usually get good results. Only a neurologist would notice a little bit of facial weakness on that side, but very, very almost unnoticeable. The very small ones, interestingly, some people will do radiation on them. I don't know if you've also seen this, or even though it's a benign tumor, some people will.
Yeah, stereotactic radiosurgery.
Stereotactic radiosurgery, even though it's benign, I think just to sort of freeze its growth in that stage. I think there's some risk of secondary tumor. These are not uncommon. So yeah, this patient would be referred for surgery, and usually it's a one and done surgery. If they can't get the whole thing technically, then sometimes they will irradiate the remaining piece to try to keep it in check. Good. A, tell us, did you have anything else you wanted to tell us about the case or any teaching points you wanted to add?
The final diagnosis is left cerebellofrontal engaged tumor, most likely shrine tumor. And they had surgery for that, but in Burma, we have limited neurosurgeon expertise to perform this kind of operation. So she has to go to another country, like Bangkok, and she had the tumor over there. And it's by retrosigmoid approach with intraoperative neuromonitoring and imaging. And the operative finding is well-encapsulated mass, compressed brainstem, cranial nerve 7 and 8. And the biopsy comes with shrine lumbar. But like after the removal of the tumor, when she came to the clinic again, she has much improved in gait and numbness, facial numbness, but the facial palsy and the reduced hearing is getting worse than before. But she's just having physical therapy for the facial weakness.
I see. Well, some of the symptoms did worsen after the surgery, which can happen. Yeah. Fantastic. Brilliant case presentation, A. Lots of great details for us to pick up on here. Great. I feel like we haven't had a good localization case in a long time. We've had headaches and encephalopathies and other things that have interesting discussion, but not kind of the real math problem, localization type of case. Wonderful presentation, A, really great work. And Andrea, Sridhara, excellent discussion, working through some of the interesting pieces here, teaching points, and some mundane teaching points and some gourmet teaching points about sensory supply to the tongue and Bruin's nystagmus, et cetera. Hope everyone takes away this multiple cranial neuropathies framework. Everyone always thinks brainstem and they get an MRI without contrast. They don't see anything. Really going to want to get contrast, fine cuts through the brainstem to try to look at the cranial nerves in the subarachnoid space, even the skull base. And remember that MRI doesn't look at the bone that well. And I have seen cases of multiple cranial neuropathies from the skull base tumors that people don't see much on the MRI. And then on CT, they see metastases to the skull base or something like that that are really apparent in retrospect on the MRI. But if you have multiple cranial neuropathies, it's a complicated differential. So I hope this framework helps. Thank you so much, everyone, for the wonderful discussion, and look forward to seeing you next time.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.